So we got a new recorder, and it seems to be working. And I brought a backup just in case. So I don't know. It says welcome, so I guess it's starting to. Please wait.
Does anybody have an extra pen?
I haven't tried
it. Oh, good. It's both working. Okay.
I have an extra pen.
Oh, pencil.
I have one.
Wrong way. Here's a pen.
Yeah, all right. Thank you.
You got to put it through the computer.
Okay, we are beginning a look at a new series of Psalms. Starting with Psalm 2, they're called the Royal Psalms because they're psalms with a special messianic reference, and that's the point behind these. And it's an interesting thing because a lot of these psalms, as you'll see, are talking about the king. In fact, one of them sounds almost secular because it's focused on the king so much, but when you read it, you can see a reference to the Messianic King in the psalm. And so you can see a lot of things talking about the King of Israel, but you can see how they would also apply to Christ as the King of the world. Because it says the King forever and ever. Well, he's the only one who's the King forever and ever. And so you'll see those kind of references throughout the psalm. So don't be surprised if we see that.
Is this the Royal Psalms?
Yeah, the Royal Psalms. And it's 2, 21, 45, 72, and 110. If you didn't get that, I can go through the list again.
Is there any reason why they repeat themselves throughout the book of Psalms? I mean, a lot of them seem repetitive.
You mean Psalms. Because a lot of the things they're praying for are repetitive. Oh. There's a whole series of Psalms where you're asking God to save you from your enemies and mm-hmm. stuff. Well, they were always being attacked by enemies from all sides.
So you just repeat it.
So just repeat it. So you keep, and they're also prayers of thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. So you thank God for all the things he gave you. So there's a lot of repetition in that as well. And then just begging for God for help, you know. There's a lot of stuff like that all through there. And then there's some other psalms where, especially Psalm 139, where you can see David trying to get more into and explore more about the relationship between man and God. And he's talking about this because you have to remember that the Jews didn't have any concept of the afterlife because that hadn't been revealed to them yet. So they didn't know what happened. You know, we talked about that last time. But you see this thing where, like in 139, David's saying, you know, no matter where I go, you're there. I can't hide from you. You know, God, no matter what I do, you're always there. You're before me, you're behind me. You know my thoughts before I speak them. You know, all this kind of stuff. It shows that intimacy of that relationship. And when you read that whole psalm, it really takes you about as far as you can go in your relationship with God until Christ comes. It's an expression of that closeness of that relationship. And you can't go any further than that because they still see a God as outside of them. You know, they talk about him up in the heavens and all. But David's in 139, he's talking about, you're right here with me. You're beside me. You're in front of me. You're behind me. You know my days. My days are numbered. You know what they are. You know, it's this whole God knows me so well, and he's right here with me all the time. And then you can't get any closer than that until Jesus comes and says, we actually reside in you when you become a child of God.
The Psalms that kind of hint at Jesus coming?
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, that's why in Luke, when the three wise men came, they were reading the predictions of the King of Israel. They go back 2,000 years. And it says, so at the time Jesus came, the people of Israel were really anticipating this Messiah to come, Bram Petrie's got a really good book about it, where he talks about the different expectations the Jews had for the Messiah.
And did they get them from the prophets?
From the prophets, because the prophets aren't always super clear mm-hmm. as to what the Messiah is going to be. And so they had this they had this notion that the Messiah, because he comes from the line of David, was going to be another David and be another king and restore Israel to the glory it had during his kingship.
He was about 2,000 years before Christ,
yeah.
David was.
Right.
And so he built his prayers on the prophets before him.
Before him. And then the prophets came after him, continuing to talk about the house of David and all. And so they had this expectation. Some people expected the Messiah to be what he actually was. Others wanted a secular king to restore Israel, make Israel the greatest nation on earth, so that all the other nations would come and want to become part of Israel. And they had a couple of other ideas about the Messiah too. So it wasn't really clear. And so when Jesus came, he not only had to kind of explain who he was, but also kind of put aside some of the false notions of the Messiah. Because a lot of people had done an uprising, if you recall. They had these different uprisings from time to time, and different people came up, and kind of people thought they might be the Messiah. But then when they got killed, you know, everybody went away. And so when they were talking about killing Jesus, remember what Gamaliel said? He said, you know, we had these other people that came by, but when we killed the leader, they all went away. And so don't worry about this. If it's not of God, it's going to go away. You know, if it is of God, you're not going to be able to stop it. So don't mess with it. You know, it's either going to die on its own or it's going to be the real thing. And so don't play Russian roulette with God, you know. He was a smart guy.
Yes.
He was considered the greatest biblical scholar of Israel. The common impression was that when Gamaliel died, the soul of the Torah died with him. And Paul was his disciple.
Oh yeah. That's
Paul was going to take his place. He was Gamaliel's disciple. And so God said, okay, if you're going to be Gamaliel's disciple, I want you to be my disciple. You know,
so go out and tell. Teacher, Gamaliel.
Yeah. He was a great rabbi.
Well, the Jews, we know, are still expecting the Messiah to come.
Yeah.
Now, have their expectations changed? Because, you know, of course,
no, I just heard this week they're expecting him momentarily. Huh. Some of them are.
Yeah, I wonder what they expect him to be. I haven't heard any modern.
Well, it'd be up to God. They haven't really.
They just want the Messiah.
They just want to come. And that's why they're trying to find the red heifer.
The red heifer.
Yeah. That is unblemished.
Didn't they come from Texas?
They sent a whole herd of them over there that seemed to be unblemished, you know. But you got to be kind of careful about why do they want this? Because they've also been doing excavations under the Dome of the Mount, where the original temple was. Mm-hmm. What they're looking for is the urn with the ashes of the heifers that were sacrificed for the first two temples.
Mm. Oh.
And I've got a book at home that was written. It's called The Three Temples. And it's talking about their expectation of the third temple, which would be the final temple.
Which is really, for us as Christians, that final temple is Christ's body,
it's not a temple.
Don't you wonder it's 2,000 years again?
Right.
You know, it's 2,000 years, you know.
It's 2,000 years.
So if they can find that urn, then they're going to have a holy war like you never saw before to get rid of the Dome of the Mount and rebuild the temple where it was before. Because the Arabs did that to insult the Jews, right? Yeah. They built their mount right where the temple was, and so they want to rebuild the third temple on that same mount, but they have to find that urn because you have to sacrifice the heifer and then take the ashes and put it in that same urn.
Why did it get lost?
Be- Well, when the Romans destroyed Israel, they couldn't find it. In 70 AD, they couldn't find it after that.
You think someone would have, you know, like the crown of thorns when the Notre Dame burned? You think someone would have grabbed it and, like, held on to it?
So, I don't know.
Was that important?
Yeah.
Well, they did with the crown of thorns.
Well, when they build the Ark of the, when they build the temple, they would love to find the Ark of the Covenant too, to put that back in.
Wow.
They say that Jeremiah is the one that hid that. And
not in Jerusalem, right?
No,
not in Jerusalem.
They got all kinds of stories about the Ark of the Covenant. The Ethiopians are supposed to have it.
Ethiopia is a big one.
Oh, you know, all kinds of stuff like this. Nobody knows where it is.
I don't know, his Ark was in Turkey. Like they used to show pictures and say
they satellite pictures of it all. Mm-hmm. So all those kind of things. So as you go through these Psalms, you'll see these references to the king, but you can also see references to the Messiah as a kind of included idea in what they're doing, because they're expecting this king. So they're expecting the Messiah to be the Messiah king. And he is. He's the Lord of Lords, you know, all this kind of stuff, but not our earthly king. He's the head of the king for the kingdom forever. His kingdom never ends. Every earthly king kingdom ends, but we'll see. It's going to be interesting.
But, would you be able to rattle off which numbers of Psalms are the royal Psalms?
Sure.
Slowly.
Sure. Number two. Sure. Number two. Number 21, number 45, number 72, and number 110. Got that? Okay. All right. So they also have a lot of discussions in these Psalms about the anointed one. They talk about the anointed. And so there were several people that were anointed. You know, the prophets got anointed, and then the kings got anointed.
Like
Saul was anointed, and then David was anointed and stuff.
By who?
By the prophet
usually. The prophet would then anoint the king. So
that doesn't always refer to Christ. Thank you.
Yeah. But there are a lot of references to the anointed one in here. And what does the Christ mean?
The anointed.
The anointed one, mm-hmm. Right. So Christ was not Jesus' last name, okay? he was not Joseph Christ and Mary Christ. And it was Jesus the Christ, Jesus the anointed. So a lot of people think it's his last name. You know, it's the way they use it sacrilegiously, it sounds like it's his last name, but it's not. His last name was not Christ. They didn't have last names back then. They referred to the Father.
Yeah.
I said, like Peter was Simon. He was the son of John, right? Simon Bar-Jonah. Bar means son of. Mm. Okay? When you look at the movie Ben-Hur, Judah Ben-Hur. Judah Bar. He was the head of the family of Hur. And so there was all these references to the lineage of the parent, but they didn't have first and last names like we did, and middle names like we do here. So, Psalm 2. God affects his plans by installing his anointed. And so when God wants to, what this psalm is saying, that when God wants to accomplish something, he anoints somebody and then gives them a mission, a job to do. And by anointing them, they are held up as the one God wants to do this, not just some local they found in an alley somewhere. This is the guy that God has chosen to do this job. And it's not always the most obvious person, like he did with David, you know. He picked the youngest one, who was the little shepherd guy, and he said, "You are the one that I want to lead Israel." So it's not always the one who looks like a leader who would end up being the leader.
Wasn't there something in the Bible, God picks the weak to confront
the strong, yeah.
The strong.
Yeah.
Always, yeah. It's never the right, never the person you think
right.
for the mission.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Mother Angelica, the network.
Yeah. So this Psalm 2 begins with conflict. It begins by talking about the nations that are trying to plot against Israel, and what they say is that they're doing this in vain, because God has appointed his anointed one who will save Israel. So it says, why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together. So they're all conspiring together. It's one big conspiracy against Israel. Why? Because Israel is a chosen people of God. So they're all going against that. So they take counsel together against the Lord and his anointed. So they always see the anointed as united somehow to the Lord. So when you attack the anointed, you're actually attacking God.
So is Lord God the Father?
The Lord would be what they understood God to be
because
at that
they
time.
Didn't have a Trinity.
They didn't have a Trinity at that time, right. So their concept of God was not just the Father, it was just God.
Right.
You know, they didn't understand that he was three persons. And so, but they're saying when you attack the anointed, you're attacking the Lord. And you better watch out. You better not cry. <You know? laughs> So the rulers will take counsel together against the Lord and his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds asunder and cast their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. So this thing, God is sitting there laughing at their efforts. The Lord has them in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. And so God is answering those who are trying to fight against Israel. So he's saying, I'm just laughing at your efforts. You're trying to conspire against me and my anointed, and I'm just laughing at you.
My Old Testament knowledge is so thin. Zion is where again? In Jerusalem. Right.
Yes, yeah.
Or is it all of Jerusalem? Or is it the center of Jerusalem?
Zion would be Jerusalem.
Which is central Jerusalem.
Center of Jerusalem.
And it is actually a hill.
Yeah.
Because they call it a mountain.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. It's the mountain where the temple is.
Okay.
It says right here, new king on Zion, that is in Jerusalem, the holy city built on a hill.
Thank you very much.
Yep. So these people are talking about Israel and how they're talking about talking against the Lord and his anointed. He said, let us burst their bonds asunder and cast their cords from us. They want to separate themselves from Israel. They want to conquer Israel and not have any kind of relationship with him. What is that like?
Like now.
It's like now. It's also like the angels when they were tested. They wanted to essentially burst the bonds that held them to God because they wanted to be on their own. And it says, let us burst the bonds of sin and cast their cords from us. They didn't want to be related to God. They wanted to be their own determiner of right and wrong and everything else.
Because Israel was about the one God.
Yeah.
And that's why they didn't want to be connected.
Right.
It was all about, I'm over.
Yeah.
Okay. Could you say Adam and Eve, too? They didn't want to obey God. They wanted to break the...
That's right.
They started it.
Yeah, they started. Blame it on them.
They started it.
Like,
or downfall.
So when you see this talking about, you know, separating yourself from God, it's just like the fallen angels. You know, they wanted to do the same thing. Just like Adam and Eve. They wanted to be like God. You know, they wanted to be themselves. And so God just kind of laughs at them, according to the psalm. You know, you can't go against God's will. You know, whatever he... And that's one thing a lot of people never think about. When God decides to do something, it happens. I mean, if he could just create the entire universe with an act of his will, you know, if he decides he wants to do something, it happens. Now, he'll give you a choice sometimes. But if he decides that something has to happen, it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And you have to just accept that. You know? Yes. You can't fight him. Mm-hmm. You can't fight God. I mean, it's
I learned, and I said those words. I learned that at 18 years old. I fought the convent. I told them I'm not leaving. I mean, I stood there in church. I said, I am not leaving. I want that habit. I want to teach. I want to be a nun. And I'm never going to leave. And I learned then, you can't fight God.
That's right.
Because I lost 30 pounds eating. I was eating. The more I ate, the more I lost.
I wish I could do that.
Yeah. I can't do it now. I mean, I was fighting God. I thought, I'm not leaving.
Gee,
that'd be my ideal.
Yeah, a good episcopal, like, oh my God, this is what you wanted. I couldn't believe it. I said, it's not what I wanted.
So the God laughs at him. But then it says he speaks to them, the ones who are fighting against him. He will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. So he's saying, whoever I put in place, that's my king. And you better not mess with my king. Mm-hmm. He belongs to me. You don't mess with whatever belongs to God. Right? If it's his, you leave it alone. It's his.
Well, was he speaking to a prophet, or is just the feeling they
got? He's probably talking to the king.
He is
whoever the king was at that time. Yeah.
As in,
right. Okay. So there were, you know, they didn't have many kings in Israel, just a few. But there was like 200 years where they had kings, and then they didn't have any kings. So then the psalmist comes back in, and he says, I will tell of the decree of the Lord. He said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. When you read that, what comes to mind?
When Jesus was being baptized in Jordan with John.
The baptism.
Yeah.
And what else? What other time did he say?
David's anointing. When David was anointed?
When David was anointed, and what else with Christ?
Yeah, he said something else. Yeah.
Besides his baptism, what else happened to Christ? The transfiguration, right. Yeah. So when you see this writing here, you can see how it's reflected further into the New Testament.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You see it reflected at the baptism of Christ in the Jordan, and then at the transfiguration, where the Father comes down and says, this is my son, listen to him. Mm-hmm. Now that was really interesting, I thought, at the transfiguration, because he's getting ready to go to Jerusalem for his passion. Mm-hmm. And the Father says, listen to him. He's been talking for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And now the Father says, listen to him. You know? So I thought that was kind of interesting.
It was a little more impressive.
A little more impressive, yeah. So don't forget what he told you. Listen to him. Do what he said to do, you know. And when you say, today I have begotten, you are my son, today I have begotten you, that sounds like you're just being born. But you can also have a spiritual birth in your baptism. What did Jesus tell Nicodemus? Unless a man is born again of water and spirit, he cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. Mm-hmm. So the day you're baptized, whether you're an adult or a child, you could say you have been begotten by God at that point, because that's when the Holy Spirit enters your soul. And then it continues on where the psalmist is kind of now speaking on behalf of God. Okay. He continues. He says, ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. Two contradictory kind of things come to mind when you see that verse 8. What comes to your mind when you see that?
Oh, the devil, when the three temptations of Christ.
Right.
Yeah.
When he was taken up, right?
Yeah.
He says, took him up to the temple, and he said, I'll show you all the nations.
Yeah.
Okay. But the other side of that is when Jesus tells the apostles, whatever you ask the Father in my name, he will give you. And so he said, ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. Whatever you ask of me. And he wants the ends of the earth to be the possession of the apostles. Because he says, go out and make disciples of all nations. That's the big commission he gave them. So you can see, even though this is like 2,000 years before Christ, you can see the reflection of what he's saying into what happens later in the New Testament time. So you see a lot of this kind of jumping from old to new in a lot of what you see in the in these Psalms. And because of that, Jesus will end up several times in the Gospels quoting some of these Psalms that kind of refer to these things. He does. He says, you shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. You shall break them with a rod of iron. In the book of Revelation, you remember what it says about the woman in the desert giving birth to the child? He will rule with an iron rod. So you
Revelation
12. Yeah. In Revelation, So you see how these things reflect. It's like you almost got a mirror, and you got the Old Testament and the New Testament. The old is reflected right into the new. You know, and it's just, it's kind of amazing.
Who is she killing in verse 12 in Revelation?
Chapter 12.
It's actually twice in Revelation. You have chapter 2 and chapter 12.
Yeah, they have a cross.
And who is she killing?
She's killing.
Oh, yeah.
I can look and see what was happening. 12.
And so does this refer to the nations?
Is it like when she was running?
And here it says, the book of Revelation. I'm sorry.
Book of Revelation, chapter 2, 26 through 27, chapter 12, verse 5, and chapter 19, verse 15. You see that idea all contained in the book of Revelation of three different places. And then dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. You also see references to how we are like the clay and God is the potter.
Yeah, what's verse 5?
What are you looking for, Mary?
Who is she dashing?
No, it's the male child who is. It's the male child. She 12:5 is she brought forth a male child. This is, you know, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron.
Oh, okay. So it's referring to Jesus, the Messiah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you can see how these things, you know, relate. So there's when you just read the Psalms, you're not just reading a song. You're reading a lot of
history.
A lot of setting up the conditions for the coming of the Messiah.
You gotta know both of them though to get the full picture.
Yeah.
To, you know, reflect back and forth.
Right.
And go, oh no, that's reflected there.
Right.
Yeah.
But you can also see why there might have been multiple expectations of what the Messiah was going to be.
Right.
Because the Psalms don't come out and say, well, the Messiah is going to be the Son of God.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, they don't say that. So you
just
can see.
Just like God says, destroy this temple and in 3 days, and he's referring to his body.
Right.
And why did he made that so just his followers could understand? I mean, why did he speak that way?
Well, because the followers wouldn't understand that until after he did rise.
I think it's for us.
And so when he rose from the dead, they remembered he said that.
Mm-hmm. So because, I mean, it seems purposely oblique.
It is. He was. Well, Jesus himself said, we have held this from the wise and the foolish, and explained it to the foolish, you know. And then in the parables, he would sometimes give a parable, and the apostles would say, well, what do you mean? He would take them aside and explained it to them by themselves. Because one of the Psalms said that he would speak in parables.
But I mean, when he's saying he's going to destroy the building, I mean, already you've got to look deeper into it.
Yeah.
How is that really going to happen?
Well, that's what they said. You're going to do this in 3 days when it's been 46 years.
Right.
Come building it.
Yeah.
And they didn't.
And they still hadn't finished it.
Well, I think they're like kind of...
You know what I'm thinking? Could you say...
Look,
he said these things for many reasons, but maybe to fulfill. He came to fulfill the Old Testament.
He did.
And he's fulfilling all the stuff here.
Exactly.
And, the apostles could see it then.
Yeah.
As you said, they look back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the ones who really knew the Old Testament well, like Paul, for example, he could see those references and understand the connections. Mm. A lot of regular people may not be able to make those connections.
And I think some of it, I think it's for us too, and all the generations that came after that. You
exactly.
See all that.
Right. Yeah.
And they even, you know, like some of the times you think, oh, why did they do that? And the next line is someone, and why are you doing that? You know, and you're like, oh, they're just trying to tell us.
Yeah. In fact, there's a note that says the actual words of verse 7, where he says, you know, you are my son, today I have begotten you. The actual words of verse 7 are quoted in the letter to the Hebrews to make the point that Christ is above the angels because he is the Son of God.
Mm-hmm. We say this all the time in the Liturgy of the Hours. Yeah. Well, I don't know what psalm it is or what it is, but we always say that.
Yeah.
This, you are my son, this day.
Now you know what psalm it is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It is
now you know what psalm it is.
It's psalm 2. Oh, right? But is it other places as well? Though?
Probably. There's a lot of repetition in the Psalms.
Yeah.
Sometimes when it's in different spots, it's like, what is the original spot that it came from?
Well, I don't know. I guess I don't know if the Psalms are in a chronological order or not.
I guess it's like the chicken and the egg.
Yeah. Somebody last week was asking about the authorship of the Psalms.
Yes, I'm curious.
And there's a note here. On page 21, if you have the Navarro Bible, says, due to the fact that David is the person to whom most Psalms are attributed, and because he enjoyed in the tradition of Israel a reputation as a good musician and poet, he was generally taken in Jewish and Christian tradition to be the author of the book. In fact, the book is also called the Psalms of David, primarily to distinguish it from another similar book, although a much shorter one and not inspired, which circulated at the time of Jesus under the title of Psalms of Solomon. Hmm. It's likely that King David himself or Solomon did compose a piece of poetry that now forms part of one psalm or another, but due to the state of the Psalms as they have come down to us, it is not possible to deduce which pieces, if any, were composed by those kings. Besides, these compositions were originally passed on orally, which means that their present shape could have developed over time. Mm-hmm. So basically, they're not sure who was the actual author of most of the Psalms. Mm-hmm. Although they are attributed to David in most of the writings, it's not really clear. So now the Psalm 2 goes on, and there's now the psalmist speaks directly to the king. He says, "Now therefore, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear, with trembling, kiss his feet, lest he be angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all who take refuge in him." So that's what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So the psalmist himself in this last part speaks again at the end of the psalm, inviting kings to act wisely. Wisdom involves acknowledging God and worshiping him. And verse 12 exhorts them to do homage to the Son, that is, to the king designated by God, in order to avoid the punishment meted out to rebels. And every time they didn't do this, God punished Israel. Mm. You know, when they didn't do this, they had the Babylonian exile, the Assyrian exile, and all this kind of stuff. The warnings about returning to God shows that God, although he can conquer, prefers to convince people. In other words, he doesn't want to force you to accept him and to love him.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever read the book that they refer to all the time, The Christ is Passing By?
No, I have not read that book.
I have another book, and they always point out
Jose Maria Escriva.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It must be a good book.
Jose Maria Escriva, yeah. Yeah. They make a lot of references to him in the Psalms, to his writings.
He's real key in the bar. Starting.
Really?
Or something. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Oh. So any further thoughts on Psalm 2? So let's go to Psalm 21. That's on page 89 if you're using the Navarro Bible. Psalm 21. The king owes his victory to the Lord. So in this one, you remember David was a warrior king. Mm-hmm. So he was always fighting battles. And because he was a warrior king, he was not allowed to build the temple.
Mm. Okay?
Because he shed blood. Okay? As a warrior king. And so God said, I'm going to give you the blueprint for the temple, but your son, who is not going to be a warrior king, has to be the one to build it. Mm-hmm. So Solomon had to build it, although he gave the blueprint for it to David. So David passed that blueprint on to Solomon, and then Solomon built the temple. Mm. And then they had the Babylonian exile. And then when the temple got destroyed, and so the king said, go back and build your temple. So they started building the second temple. And one of the people that came back, who remembered what the first temple looked like, looked at the second temple and then wept. He said it was the glory of the first temple was so much greater than the glory of the second temple, which is interesting. So he apparently didn't follow the blueprint that Solomon had. But when Solomon's temple was built, I mean, he had things, they took pounded gold and covered things in gold, the temple and all. I mean, it was probably a magnificent building. Yeah. Why the Romans didn't just take all this gold and keep it, and I don't know. They just destroyed it. I guess.
Well, second temple didn't have that, though. The second temple didn't have that. No. It was in, like, after the Babylonian exile.
Yeah.
So 400 BC or something.
Right. And they were still building it when Jesus was there. It still hadn't been built yet. Because remember when he said it?
46 years. Is that Herod's temple?
Herod's temple. Herod was very proud of the fact that he was a good builder. He decided he was going to build this temple.
And so this temple that Herod was building, that it refers to in the New Testament, is this second temple that got started in 400 BC or whatever?
Right, it's the one that Jesus practiced in. Mm.
Do they have any of the, like, remains of it?
Not much.
The old town Jerusalem?
They got the Wailing Wall. That's about all that's left.
Yeah, that's right, the Wailing Wall.
Of everything.
So that's part of it. Wow.
But that's why they're excavating underneath it. Mm-hmm. To try. And it's interesting, when they excavated underneath it, they had, I'm going to digress here for a second just because it's interesting. Mm-hmm. When you went into the first temple, Solomon's temple, they were have incense going in the morning and then again at night because they would do a lot of sacrifices. So people were sacrificing stuff all day long. Because they would bring sacrifices, you know, turtle doves for this or with that. And if you committed something really bad, you had to use a bullock. So they would do all these things. They just happened once a year. They would go on all the time. So they would. They made the incense in these big blocks that were 600 pounds. And they're big cubes. And so the high priest would chop off about a foot cube in the morning and a foot cube at night, and he would use that for the incense, and then it would take a year to go through one of those big blocks. Mm-hmm. Well, when there was only one family that knew how to make it. They have the formula for the incense in the book of Exodus, but not all the pieces or not all the ingredients are included in the book of Exodus. You got to go to the Mishnah to find out what the rest of it is. And what's interesting about the incense is that there's one ingredient of the incense that stinks. But when you mix it with all the others, it turns into a good smell. And the spirituality behind that was that you take somebody who's not good, you put him into the company of Israel, and he becomes good. You put him into the company of good people, and he becomes a good person. And when they burned that incense, it didn't just kind of come up in this big cloud and fill the thing. It came up in a straight column, straight up, just like the column of cloud that followed him across the desert.
Okay? I wonder how they did that to make it too.
So there was only one family that knew how to make that incense. Because they had to combine it just in, you know, two teaspoons of this and one teaspoon of that kind of thing. Only one family made it. And they wouldn't tell anybody else how they did it.
Oh, no.
So the art of making that got lost. But when they were excavating under the under the dome of the rock under the old temple, they found one of those blocks of incense. It weighed 600 pounds.
Wow.
So they found one of those. So now they're all excited because if they can find, now that they found the incense, if they can find the heifer and find that urn, they got everything they need.
When did they find the incense? How long ago is that?
Oh, I read that 4, 5, 6 years ago. So they've got it captured. Hi. And so they have that. So they have the incense. If they can find the urn, and if they can find the unblemished heifer, they've got everything they need to build the temple and then dedicate the temple. Because they have to sacrifice the heifer, put its ashes in the same urn as the other urn, and then you're going to see a holy war like you never saw before. So that's probably not going to happen. Because I don't think God would let that happen. But that's the goal. That's the goal. So they got the... So that's why they're excavating under there. They're dying to find that urn.
It's the Jews that are excavating under there.
Yeah.
The Arabs allow them to do that?
Yeah, well, they don't know any better.
They don't know
better. You know,
but they think they have that heifer, don't they?
Well, they think they have possibly, but it has to be a certain age. And so they took the young calves and they shipped them over there to Israel. So they're waiting to see if, as they grow up, do they actually, if they just one white hair on that heifer, it becomes a blemish and they can't use it. So all the rabbis are watching it with a microscope every day, you know, see if making sure it's unblemished.
Made me think of that Ezekiel bread. Is that what it is? They said the recipe is like in the Bible.
Yeah. Oh, the Ezekiel bread. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wedman sells it.
And so does John.
I tried it.
They sell Ezekiel's bread.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, they sell Ezekiel bread.
Ezekiel bread. Yeah.
I had a hard time eating it. Sorry.
You did? I don't know if I haven't tried it yet.
It's supposed to be good. Yeah, it's supposed to be good for you, though.
Yeah,
I know.
It's supposed to be good for you.
I might try it again.
There's also a recipe for the bread they use in Medjugorje for the fasting on Wednesday and Friday.
Huh. Oh, yeah. Oh, really? There's a special bread for that? You were there.
Yeah. Well, because it's not this stuff that rats will die of starvation on if they eat it, you know, like we have. It's actually nutritious
bread. Oh yeah, I'd like to get that. It probably doesn't have any GMOs in it either.
Yeah, it's probably not. Yeah. So I think I have the recipe, and so if you want it, I can send it out to you.
Yeah.
It'd be fun to make some of that bread.
Yeah.
But the Blessed Mother asked him to fast on bread and water every Wednesday and Friday, but she didn't say use, you know, Wonder Bread. She said use the bread in Medjugorje.
Wow. The bread that they were already making there.
Yeah.
Wow.
Because it's nutritious.
They should have had bread
there. It's a meal, basically.
We need to go back.
Just for
the So I think I have that recipe. So.
Maybe there's lots of protein in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if I can find the recipe, I'll send it out to you.
Okay.
That's a good thing for Lent.
Yeah. Be good. Okay. Psalm 21. It is 10:14. Okay. We'll get started. So this is a psalm speaking to a king. Okay, and it says it's a psalm of David. So maybe David wrote it, maybe he didn't. We don't know. But it's definitely a psalm to a king, a warrior king who has been in battle and been victorious in battle. So that's the kind of background for this psalm. It says, in thy strength the king rejoices, O Lord, and in thy help how greatly he exalts. So right off the bat it's saying, you were a king, you were victorious because of God, because he helped you. Not because of anything you did, but only because of God. Thou hast given him his heart's desire, and has not withheld the request of his lips. He requested, of course, victory.
What does that Selah mean again? I've forgotten. It's the all what? Over, like after this little verse, it says Selah. And when you're listening to the Bible, sometimes they'll tell you Selah. You see that after the
S-E-L-A-H.
S-E-L-A-H.
Oh, yeah.
It's all over. Oh. It was after the first paragraph of 20 and...
20. I don't have it in mind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, it's over on the side right there.
Yeah,
it is. It's on our screen. It's like a little...
Oh, so I see. Yeah, okay, yeah. I don't know what that is.
I was told once, but of course I can't remember.
I don't know. We have to Google that and find out. Yeah, yeah. Let's Google that and find out. I don't know who that is. Yeah. It says, thou hast given him his heart's desire, which is victory, and has not withheld the request of his lips. So the king was obviously asking for something, requested something, and has given him what he requested. For thou dost meet him with goodly blessings, thou dost set a crown of fine gold upon his head. So there's some notes here on Psalm 21 that are kind of interesting. It says, closely connected with the previous psalm, which besought God to hear the king's appeal, now we see him being thanked for giving the king victory and glory. Both psalms would have been composed for royal liturgies in the temple prior to the exile. So there are two parts to the psalm. In the first, addressed to God, it puts on record that the king's success comes from God. And that's verses 1 through 6. The second part of the psalm is addressed to the king, encourages him to destroy his enemies in the name of the Lord. And that's verses 8 through 12. The two sections are divided by a proclamation of the king's trust in the Lord, and that's verse 7. And the psalm ends with a short entreaty and promise to praise God. So it's got two parts. First part, the king's success comes from God. Second, addressed to the king, to destroy your enemies in the name of the Lord. Don't destroy your enemies only to satisfy yourself. You do it in the name of the Lord. And then they're two divided by a proclamation of having trust in the Lord. Now the king of Israel is going to go into battle against those who are trying to attack him. The kings of Israel don't initiate war just to conquer some other people. It's self-defense. And they've been doing that ever since. Mm. They've always been in self-defense mode. The Philistines were always after them, and Goliath and everybody else. So they're always so they said, when you destroy your enemy, do it in the name of the Lord. Don't just do it for self-satisfaction, because you are the anointed one of God. The king is the anointed. Okay, so that's another big thing to keep in mind. In this psalm, when you talk about the king, you're talking about the anointed one of God. Mm-hmm. Okay. So he's still talking to God here. He says, he, meaning the king, he asked life of thee, and thou gavest it to him. Length of days forever and ever. Now he says the king's going to last a long time, but the only king who's going to last forever and ever is Christ, mm-hmm. the king. And so you can see right away a reference going forward to Christ in that.
Does that relate back to when they asked for a king?
Yeah, it goes back. Well, the first one they asked for was Saul, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then David, and then Solomon, and then Solomon's sons, who were really terrible. And then the whole kingship thing went away.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't last long.
Mm-hmm.
But it does go back to that time, yes. So he asked life of thee, thou gavest to him. So you saved his life. He wasn't killed in battle. Length of days forever and ever. He lived a long time. And his glory is great through thy help. Splendor and majesty thou dost bestow upon him. Yea, thou dost make him most blessed forever. And again, the only king who is blessed forever is Jesus.
Mm.
So twice we see something talking about the king that we can refer directly to Christ in here. Mm. Thou dost make him glad with the joy of thy presence. And that's the thing here. The joy of thy presence. Joy of the... This is another place where, like in Psalm 139, you have an allusion to God being present with you. Okay? It makes the king glad because of the joy of the presence of the Lord with him. So that does make him glad with the joy of thy presence. So the king is really happy that the Lord is is present to him. And that's a big deal back then. And that's something that David was apparently more conscious of than a lot of the others. And we see that reflected in 139, as we talked about before. So the gifts bestowed on the king exceed those he requested, for he has already been blessed with a crown and with splendor, majesty, and the joy of God's presence. The words of verse 4 can be read as finding fulfillment in Jesus Christ. The verse 4, of course, was, he asked of the life that gave it to him, the length of days forever and ever. Okay. And then there's a quote from the book, from the letter to the Hebrews, that references that Jesus is the Christ. And he gives eternal salvation to all who obey him. And then verse 7 says, for the king trusts in the Lord, and through the steadfast love of the Most High, he shall not be moved. So as long as he trusts in the Lord and his steadfast love of God, he's not going to get moved off his throne. His throne's going to be there. Then the prediction, of course, was that the throne of David would be forever, because through the line of David would be a king that would rule for all time. Mm. And that, of course, would be Christ. Mm. And then it goes on to verse 8, talking directly to the king now and about his battles, because he's a warrior king. It says, your hand will find out all your enemies, your right hand will find out those who hate you. And again, we see a reference to the right hand as being the hand that acts in the place of God. We talked about that last time, about the right hand was always important. You will make them as a blazing oven when you appear. The Lord will swallow them up in his wrath, and fire will consume them. The note says that the king's enemies are also God's enemies, and the king is but an instrument that God uses to punish them. Fire symbolizes punishment. So it doesn't mean that he's going to burn them all up with an actual fire. It's just a poetic expression that they're going to be defeated because of the king, okay? Doesn't mean they're actually going to get burnt up. Where God does do that, we saw with Sodom and Gomorrah, we sent down fire and burnt them up, but that's not what this is talking about here. And it brings up a question, just because God tells David to go kill these people, does it mean that they're going to hell?
Yeah, that's a question.
Yeah. It's just their time is up.
Just their time is up.
Their time is up on earth.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Probably not. Mm-hmm. Because you can't hold people responsible for what they don't know.
Right.
And these people don't know any better. They're probably descendants of the Canaanites, which were the people that God told Joshua to get rid of. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they never did do it when they first crossed the Jordan after the desert.
Mm-hmm. And their children, when he says their offspring will be destroyed forever and their children, it means they're not killing their children, but because they kill them, they won't have children?
I guess, yeah. You will destroy their offspring from the earth and their children from among the sons of men.
Unless it's just repetitive.
And the reason God did that, but he told Joshua that, was because they're going to contaminate you with their false gods and their idolatry and everything else. And so he said, you are my people, my chosen people. I don't want you to be contaminated. Mm-hmm. So get rid of the contaminant. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean the contaminant's going to go to hell. Mm-hmm. So God in his justice is going to deal with them the way that is just. You know? They didn't know God. They had no knowledge of him. They didn't worship him. But we don't know how he dealt with them.
The Solomon was really contaminated by those other gods, by all his wives that worshiped those other gods.
That's right.
So he got into it too.
Yeah.
Solomon was David's son. David never did, but it was his big sin, right?
Yeah. Solomon married all these people to establish relationships with other kingdoms. He does that through marriage. Mm-hmm. He probably didn't even know half of his wives. He had like 700 of them. I can't imagine.
I can't imagine.
You know, one is more than enough that I can handle. I can't handle 700. There's no way.
I agree with you.
There's no way I can handle 700. Not that I would handle them. They would handle me, which they did with Solomon, apparently.
Yeah.
But he was establishing peace with these countries by marrying in, you know, into their families and all. And so they became like kin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that was his objective there, not to, you know, have 700 wives.
Because I mean, it's only 350 days.
I mean, the guy never would have reached that age he did. He'd have been so exhausted. You know, it would have been impossible. So he probably didn't even know 3/4 of them.
Yeah.
So the Lord will swallow them up in his wrath, and fire will consume them. He will destroy their offspring from the earth and their children from among the sons of men. If they plan evil against you, if they devise mischief, they will not succeed, for you will put them to flight. You will aim at their faces with your bows. And why aim at the faces?
Yeah, I don't know.
Because they're wearing armor.
Oh.
Mm. The arrows might bounce off the armor, but the faces are exposed. Wow. So if you hit somebody in the face with a good arrow, it's
right
going to kill
them.
Mm. It's going to go right to the brain and kill them.
Mm.
And which is kind of an interesting little thing there.
Mm.
The note there on 8 through 12 says, we read that. Yes, it says God uses the instruments to punish them. Yeah. Mm. Okay. Then it ends up saying, be exalted, O Lord. So it goes back to God now. He was talking to the king. Now he's going back and talking to God. It says, be exalted, O Lord, in thy strength. We will sing and praise thy power. And verse 13, the note on verse 13 says, God's strength is extolled here as in verse 1, but now the beneficiary is the people. In verse 1, the king was the beneficiary. Mm-hmm. Now it's the people.
Mm-hmm.
By aiding the king, God also helps his people. And that completes Psalm 21.
Good.
So it is 10:29, so we will stop here rather than take 1 minute to get into the next one.
Good.
So we'll
45.
A little continuity there. So 45 will be the next one we go to.
45.
Yep. Anybody have any thoughts before we terminate this?
Jim, did you want to mention something about Cabrini, movie on Friday?
Yeah, the Cabrini movie is coming out Friday.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be at the Regal Theaters in Gainesville and probably in Fredericksburg. So
it's on like 3 times a day.
Yeah, so you want to
get... It's on the 8th, it's on the 11th, the 12th.
Yeah, so if you want to go see that, you would want to call... Might want to call ahead at Regal and get tickets. You can get tickets online if you want.
It's Royal from it. Or Regal.
Regal Theaters.
Gainesville maybe too.
On Linton Hall.
Yeah, okay. So I heard The Chosen was playing there at one point too.
Oh, really?
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know.
I read a review a long time ago. I
called
it was
Cabrini.
In the Arlington Herald.
It's about Mother Cabrini.
And it wasn't 100%.
The first American saint.
But there are other reviews that are saying it's the best movie ever made.
Really?
And it was starting out just to be one time thing, and now it's a week.
Oh,
all right.
You can't believe every review.
Yeah.
We should get a group together.
Even secular reviewers.
Yeah. Oh, that's good.
Are saying it's
that's
great.
Good. Yeah.
She was amazing.
Okay.
Regal. It's produced by the same person who produced The Sounds of Freedom.
Oh,
yeah.
I forgot what it's called.